Welcome, everyone. My name is Danielle Farmer. I am a community mental health trainer here on the UCLA PMHP team. If this is your first training with us, welcome. It's good to have you. Some of the names look a little familiar, so I feel like some of you have been in our previous trainings or in some of our learning communities, so welcome back. So I am a licensed clinical social worker. Prior to joining the team here at UCLA, I worked in school-based mental health, so I worked as a school counselor and school social worker. In the Bay Area and here in Los Angeles, specifically in SPOSIX. So shout out to SPOSIX if any of you are in that area. But in that role, I did a lot of collaboration, right? Oftentimes in the schools that I was at or my placement, I was the only mental health professional there. So a big part of my role is collaborating with other people. So whether that be teachers, admin, outside partnerships, families. And so I picked up a lot of kind of tips and best practices on the way. So I'm excited to be here with you today just to kind of share some best practices that I've found to be really helpful when you're working with youth clients and just things that have been really helpful for me. So like I said, if you haven't done so already, please put your name and your agency and your role in the chat. Well, first, just because, you know, welcome. But also more importantly, I really want to get a feel for who's in the room, what kind of agencies are represented today, what kind of roles. And it looks like there is a nice representation of clinical work, case management work, some school-based work. So, you know, that's near and dear to my heart. So welcome. So great. So yeah, hopefully no matter what agency or role you're specifically in, hopefully you'll still be able to find something useful from today, something that'll help as you think about how to coordinate care on behalf of your youth clients. One thing I want to shout out is my colleagues, Elizabeth Mackey and Chelsea Sims. They did a really awesome training collaborative that talked about integrated care and specifically focused on FSP. A lot of the data and a lot of the content from today came from that training. So I definitely want to shout them out. All right, so our objectives for today, we'll discuss the importance of and some of the theoretical concepts behind team-based care. We won't spend too much time on it. I really want the bulk of it to kind of feel helpful and really tangible for you, but we will spend a little bit of time on that. We'll define care coordination as it relates to professional collaboration. We'll troubleshoot and kind of discuss some common barriers that come up during care coordination and collaboration. We'll talk about some best practices for identifying and engaging with care partners. We'll review some of the legal and ethical considerations when exchanging information with care partners. And then finally, we'll put that to practice. All right, so populations served by DMH. So the most of your agencies or departments or whoever you work for are either run by or contracted through DMH. That's usually how you hear about these trainings. And so The programs that are focused on youth mental health, like child FSP, child welfare, TBS, they all serve a specific population of youth. And usually these are youth who have a higher level or specialized level of mental health needs. So that could be youth with serious emotional disorders, severe mental illness, children and youth with special health care needs, system-involved youth, youth experiencing homelessness or housing stability or maybe impacted by trauma. And many of these identities are interconnected, right? So it kind of just increases the likelihood that a client would fit into one or more of these categories. And so when you think about your caseload and this, whether you're starting out as an intern or whether you're more veteran, when you think about the youth specifically that are on your caseload, how many of your clients would you say fit into one or more of these categories? And again, you could put it in the chat, you can unmute yourself, whatever feels comfortable, but how many of your clients or what percentage of your caseload would you say fits into these categories? 85%, yeah. 80% in the chat, yeah. Yeah, I would guess a large part, right? A majority of your caseload would probably 100%. Yeah, a majority of your caseload would probably fall into one of these categories. And so because of these complex needs that a lot of the youth that you're serving have, that increases the vulnerability of these populations too. And oftentimes a lot of these needs are not getting met in kind of streamlined ways. Unfortunately, that can lead to a lot of barriers. And so some of the barriers that face the populations that your clinics or your organizations are working with can really be an increase risk for suicidal ideation or behaviors. A lot of the identity markers that we described on the previous slide, like chronic mental health conditions, chronic physical medical conditions, homelessness or trauma, all of those have been associated with increased risk in suicidal ideation. Youth with severe mental illness are also at increased risk for prolonged homelessness. One thing that we're seeing, I'm sure across the board, but you know, of course, we can speak specifically to Los Angeles, is really just a strain on our community and county mental health resources. So when families are seeking out resources and mental health services for their children, we're seeing full caseloads, wait lists of 6 months or more, and really too a shortage of inpatient beds. Since the pandemic, there's been such an increase in hospitalizations for youth. And so even like up to 50% increases in hospitalizations since before the pandemic. And unfortunately, hospitals just can't keep up with the growing need. And so we're just seeing a lot of gaps in terms of county availability. And being in Los Angeles, we see there's an unbalanced distribution of resources, right, and wealth. And so we're seeing that families who have the ability to pay out of pocket or maybe with some certain private insurances are not able to access as much care or as much streamlined or integrated support maybe as families who are paying with Medi-Cal or don't have insurance. So we're seeing some of these barriers play out. Another one that can come up with are the target population are people who, families and children who need more specialized support, is just kind of knowledge gaps in community mental health resources. A lot of times families will bring their concerns to the people who see the child more often. So that could be a teacher, that could be their basketball coach, a pastor, their pediatrician. And sometimes those people who are, you know, in their own scope, incredibly supportive, but they don't always have awareness of all of the mental health and various other domains that exist in LA. And so they're not sure where to turn, or they're not sure where to turn the family to. And then finally, fragmented care. And this really comes up specifically with families or children who have really complex web of needs, right? So depending on the severity of the child's illness or condition, families are communicating with different, lots of different professionals, lots of different buildings, different agencies, having to make different appointments. And sometimes they're communicating with each other and sometimes they're not, right? And so that's a lot of burden on the family. That's really overwhelming for parents and families. So we're really seeing families impacted by that as well. What else are you seeing or kind of barriers that are coming up for your populations, for maybe the youth that your communities or your agencies are working with? So when we think about what are some best practices for families and youth with complex mental health needs, a big part of that, because they're, like I said, care can be so fragmented, is team-based care and really looking at ways to collaborate and coordinate care for these families, for these children, in ways that are organized and effective. And so when this happens, there's a lot of evidence to show that we can improve social and behavioral functioning, cognitive functioning even. When it comes to hospitalization, we see that when teams or when providers take a team-based approach and coordinate with each other, we see improved family functioning. Hospitalization is decreased, or the length of stay is decreased. Improved juvenile justice outcomes, increased communication and linkages to community resources, and just overall clearer roles and responsibilities amongst providers. So as with many things in the social sciences world, there are many ways to define what it means to work together as a team. And so that's good news and that's bad news, right? But depending on how you see it, there's a lot of different ways that you can structure this. So Nick Goodman really created a great visual model for how to think about team-based care. And so a lot of you will fall somewhere on this continuum. And that's too why I wanted to get a feel for what a lot of your roles are. So we start off with coordinated care. And so this can look when people, I think, especially people maybe on the outside of care services, when they think about traditional kind of case management, this may be what they think of. So there are some collaborations on specific tasks. So like maybe through occasional phone calls or visits, like a therapist calling a psychiatrist's office for a shared client to check in on their prescription or to check in on how the sessions are going, or a social worker calling a school to check on maybe attendance records or something like that. Usually in this side of the continuum, the professionals are all coming from different agencies, different buildings, different health records. So, you know, needing releases to speak to everyone. And you might kind of have a general idea of what each person that you're coordinating with does, but not really an understanding of how they fit within their bigger organization or their agency. So just kind of at a distance, kind of collaborating with other people. As we go up to the next level of care, it would be called co-located care, excuse me. So this type of collaboration happens between professionals who are usually kind of working for the same agency or maybe the same umbrella organization or county. So this leaves a little bit more room for open communication because you might share the same building, you might see them more often, you might be on similar kind of outreach or clinical teams, maybe you have like team huddles together or meetings together where you can talk about shared clients. But you still are all performing within the scope of your own individual role. So this can look like an FSP team that has, you know, an LCSW and a parent partner and a case manager who all talk to each other because they work together. But they also kind of function within their own roles and their own caseload. And then as we go to the last part of the continuum, this would be called integrated care. So in these settings, they really operate as one unit where all the professionals work together. They kind of operate with shared treatment plans. They all work with the same exact clients. They're definitely all together in the same building on the same team, usually the same kind of electronic health records they share. And so there's a lot of integration, and we see this a lot more kind of like in the medical side. So like inpatient treatment care, things like that. The medical home model, that would all fall on this kind of opposite end of the continuum. And then, of course, like, it's a spectrum, right? So you might have elements of some and fall somewhere in the spectrum. But if you're thinking about your care, your role at your organization, when you think about your youth clients, where would you say you fall? And again, chat, unmute yourself, whatever feels comfortable. But I would love to know kind of where folks feel like they fall on this continuum. And it might be different for each client too. You know, for some clients, you might have an integrated team that's identified, and for some, it looks more coordinated. So the first and second. So a lot of variety. So a range, right? Yeah, it seems like the consensus is it's a range. So somewhere, most of them are somewhere between 2 to 6-ish. So around the middle point is where it seems like a lot of us lie. Okay, so the good news is that, you know, despite the various ways you can collaborate with others, hopefully a lot of the strategies and things that we'll talk about today can apply no matter where you fall, no matter if you're an integrated team that functions together as a set team every single day without fail, or if you are starting from scratch and a lone provider and having to create your team from scratch. Hopefully you'll still be able to find something useful. So when we define our work, the collaborative work that we do as care coordinators, as case managers, whether you're on the clinical side, whether you're on the case management side, we hear so many different names for the actual tasks of organizing people for the sake of a client. We might hear case management, care coordination, care management, system of care, right? Collaborative care. Depending on who you talk to, what article you read, what field you're in, you might hear a lot of different terms. And a lot of them are also used interchangeably, right? What one position might be referred to as a case manager at one agency, you might do the same exact work and be named as a care coordinator at another agency. So there's lots of different ways to define. And there are certain nuances that, you know, differ between all of them, but essentially, when we think about this training and the word that we'll use to describe, you know, conducting tasks with other people for the sake of your client, we'll call it care coordination. So when you hear me say a care coordination or care coordinator, it doesn't refer to a specific type of job description. It just means the tasks that you all are doing, whether you're a therapist or a housing support specialist or a child and family specialist, all of the tasks that you're already doing to collaborate with other people and coordinate on behalf of your client. So let's define that and kind of come up with a good shared definition for our training for today and see if it feels like it fits what you all are already doing. So one thing I've found is this care coordination is a patient and family-centered, assessment-driven, and team-based activity designed to meet the needs of children and youth while enhancing the caregiving capabilities of families. Care coordination addresses interrelated medical, social, developmental, behavioral, educational, and financial needs to achieve optimal health and wellness outcomes. And then another piece that I found that I really like that I wanted to add on is it's the process of helping a person with a mental illness to access a range of different services in a way that helps them get better and works towards their recovery. It involves interactions between clinicians and healthcare providers, the individual, which would be the child, their caregivers, family members, and other significant persons. So how do we feel about that definition? Does it feel like when you think about the tasks that you're doing to coordinate care on behalf of your youth clients, does that feel like it kind of fits somewhere within that frame or that definition? So that, I mean, you bring up an amazing point. Thank you. Of just like part of our role too is breaking stigma, right? And having to advocate for our field and for our clients and in other systems that don't always look out for our clients or for their mental health or for things that come up for us. And so we're having to not only treat the client and the family, but also treat systems that sometimes weren't designed for us as mental health clinicians or mental health professionals. So that definitely is a really good point.
This is for another discussion.
We could definitely, it could be a whole training in its own for sure.
Yeah, we can talk another time.
anything else that you would add to this or that you think is important when you're thinking about your care coordination? I see some agreement with being an advocate in here in the chat. All right. So when we think about care coordination, there are a lot of barriers that can come up for us, right? So the first one can be kind of personal challenges, and that can look like, you know, knowledge gaps. Maybe you as a professional are newer to the field or new to the region, to the area. Maybe you've moved, so you don't yet have like a lay of the land, or cultural differences can play a part in just not knowing where to connect or where to reach out and build those bridges. Burnout and compassion fatigue is always a barrier whenever we're talking about most topics with mental health providers. But sometimes feeling like you're running and running and running and doing all these things for the client or for the family. And I've heard clinicians or providers sometimes say, like, I feel like I'm working harder than the family, or I feel like I'm, doing more. That feeling in itself is a sign of burnout, right? And so knowing and having that become a challenge, especially when you have things like large caseloads, we see some of these systemic challenges, large caseloads or, not getting enough funding, or like Alejandro brought up, like having these larger powers or other systems that you're having to work with or within that aren't made or don't align with mental health. So that could be a really big barrier to being able to coordinate the way that you want to. Challenging provider interactions, right? And so there won't always be providers that have the same urgency as you or that will call you back right away. And so having that engagement can be really hard, or people on the team who may not follow through on what they're supposed to, or just competing priorities, right? They're having a multidisciplinary approach or a team approach to serving a child can be a beautiful thing, in that lots of different domains of their life are taken care of. But sometimes the byproduct of that is everyone has their own vested interests or their own priority or thing that they think is top of mind or most urgent, which can be hard. And that especially can feel overwhelming for the family, right? When they're hearing, you need to focus on this, or no, you need to focus on that first, or you need to make sure the child has this first. So sometimes we as care coordinators or whatever your role is, your goal sometimes can be to help the family triage, what's most important. And then, of course, when we think of, so we touched a little bit about, systemic challenges like large caseloads and system unalignment. Then there's also client challenges, right? When we're working with youth clients, we have to balance self-determination with best interest, which is really hard. Sometimes our client wants one thing or doesn't want one thing. And we think that the best option is the opposite, right? And that's hard no matter what age, but it's especially hard when it's with children, because we know that they also legally can't make a lot of the decisions that we wish that they had the power to. And so sometimes that can lead us to feeling a little hopeless as providers as well. All right, so what I thought would be most helpful is when we think about tangible best practices and strategies to conduct collaboration or care coordination on behalf of youth, to kind of break it up into a few buckets. So the first one is the who, and this would be identifying what existing care partners can I collaborate with. And in some settings, it might be really clear, right? If you're in on that more integrated side of the spectrum, it might be really clear who your team is, who you're supposed to report to, who you're supposed to collaborate with, who you're supposed to update, and you have it all set. But on the less integrated side of the spectrum, you might have to do a little bit of digging. So we'll talk about who are some key players. The next part is the how, right? So this is what kind of communication and engagement methods are going to be most effective in being able to exchange information with these partners. And just as importantly, building that relational trust with them so that you can work together. So we'll talk about some of those strategies. Next is the what. So once you've identified the who you're going to talk to, how you're going to talk to them, now what do you share with them, right? What do you exchange with them? So we'll talk a little bit about the legal side, what you can exchange, and then the a more ethical gray side of what should you talk to them about. And then the last piece, the what else, is just referring to constantly being in the process of evaluating gaps that come up. So as transitions occur, so, for example, clients getting older, going to new grades, transitioning, you want to frequently be checking in with your cases and ensure that you're keeping a pulse and finding out if your plan is working, if things are going well, and if you're meeting their needs. So the who, we're starting off with kind of key stakeholders that support the success of your client across domains. So when you're working with youth clients, we know, of course, the first and foremost system that you're going to be collaborating with is their family, right? It's for better or worse. And oftentimes it's for the better, right? It's we want to build the capacity of the family and of the guardians to be able to effectively meet the needs of the child. So in this first step of identifying who should you coordinate and collaborate with within the family, you have to ask critical questions and sometimes use multiple sources to identify who are the key players. And so first is finding out who has physical custody of the child, right? Who does the child live with? Who day to day, if you needed to reach the child right now, who would you have to call in order to see them? And again, it could be, as we know, it could be a biological parent, it could be a relative, it may be formal, informal. And so there's a lot of moving parts that you want to be sure you have a good grasp on. The next thing, once you know who has physical custody, you also want to know who has legal custody, because these aren't the same thing. Oftentimes they are. And oftentimes, no matter what the situation is, living-wise, the biological parent has these legal rights to sign off on paperwork, make decisions, unless it's been terminated. So that's something super important that you're going to want to know. Because just because they live with someone doesn't mean that person has the authority to make these health and educational decisions for them. And so that's something that you really want to find out, in your intake process, maybe having a system for finding out if there's any kind of legal things you should be aware of, finding out who has educational rights or legal rights to sign off on paperwork. That's something that's super important that you're going to want to know when you first start off with a family. I wanted to put this resource on your radar. It's called a caregiver affidavit. And so if you ever find yourself in a situation where the person that your youth client is living with doesn't have legal rights to sign off on paperwork, so maybe like health insurance things or educational, signing a child up for school, signing a child up for services, signing releases of information, that person can apply to, can fill out this form called a caregiver affidavit. And it doesn't change custody or anything like that. But what it does is it allows that person who's watching the child, like who's actually caring for them day to day, it allows them to be able to sign off on some of the paperwork that otherwise they might not be able to. And so they would just have to get it notarized and then they bring it with them when they're signing important paperwork. So I know in my work with foster youth, or when we were doing coordination on behalf of youth who kind of had gray kind of living situations, this form came up a lot and was super helpful. So wanted to put that on your radar. After the family, the next kind of system that you want to evaluate who the key players are just the various systems that a child can be involved in. And in a lot of cases, you might already know because maybe the child came from that program and that's how they got access to your specific program. Or maybe, you know, especially like if you work for a wraparound program, you might already know who the DCFS players are, for example. But again, if not, you want to have structured ways that you're gathering this data. So maybe during the intake process, if you're doing a biopsychosocial eval for a client, this is something, you know, part of the questions that you want to ask. But finding out what systems the child is involved in is super important for a few reasons. First, it can really impact what additional services may be available to them. So you might be in search of a specific service for them, and then you find out, oh, they're involved in this system. Great. I know that that means now they're eligible for this service, right? And so it can really open up what they're eligible to receive. It also can help you determine what they're already receiving. That way you're not duplicating services. And then it really can help you get a feel for how many directions the client and the family is being pulled in too. So if you find out, oh, wow, you actually have 10 different providers that you're working with, it can help you feel a little more empathetic towards their situation if they're maybe slow to respond or if they forget your appointment time or what goal you're working on. You can realize, like, of course you do, because you're pulled in so many different directions. So it can really help you to kind of keep that humanistic view of the family. And then lastly, it's really important because if you're coordinating any kind of meetings, it's helpful to know who all should be at the table. So the first system that we can think about is the Department of Child and Family Services, so DCFS. So it's important to know if your child client that you're working with has a caseworker or an attorney. A lot of times, if there's an open investigation, an attorney will be assigned to the child. So it's important to know that. Oftentimes because they want to be invited to a lot of the meetings that you might have on behalf of the client, or if custody or if parents' rights have been terminated, sometimes if it hasn't been reassigned, then the case manager will say the attorney is the one who signs off on paperwork. So all of these kind of legal players that could be at play, it's important to know who they are. Another important role to know if they're involved in your client's life is a CASA. And so this is a lay person who just volunteers as a mentor or advocate, an ally to children in the foster care system. And I found that these particular roles are really helpful to have, especially in times where you're having like a case conference or a child and family team meeting where you have representatives from each part of a child's life. And especially if the child can't be there, you know, for whatever reason or for confidentiality, having the CASA there could be really helpful because you know that their task and their charge is just speaking on behalf of the child's voice. So they can be another great resource as well. And then in that same vein, you definitely want to know if the youth that you're working with is involved in juvenile justice system, to know if there's a probation officer involved or an attorney involved through that system. The next one is the school system. So obviously I'm biased. Like I said, that's where my background is. And I saw in the chat, there's a couple folks who are school-based, but there really is a lot of research that shows that schools play a really important part in kind of coordinating that mental health piece for kids, because kids are there all day, right? And so they're able to kind of see the needs that come up throughout the day. They're able to understand trends that are coming up, and they're able to be that a place to house services where a lot of different services can occur. So you definitely, if you're working with a youth client, you do not need to collaborate with every single person that the child interacts with at school. There's no time for that, right? And it's not necessary. But you really want to find out what are the most pressing areas or highest leverage areas that are coming up for school, and maybe try and coordinate with those one or two people. So that could be their teacher. It could be their school counselor, if there is one. If you have a client that has been referred to your program or your agency, and there's a large amount of specialized mental health needs, chances are the school counselor is probably already aware of them, or they've probably already come up on the radar. But so they're a great resource. Or the truancy officer, sometimes they're called a registrar or an attendance liaison, but they're also great people to touch base with. One of the biggest allies and collaborative partners at a school is the front office staff. And these are people who sometimes it can be secretaries, sometimes it might be office managers. But these are often the, to me, they're definitely kind of the backbones of schools. They're the first people that you'll usually interact with when you're trying to collaborate with a school. So whether it's calling or visiting the front office, they're kind of the first people that you'll run into. And they are really kind of the gatekeepers for a lot of the data from school. And that could be quantitative data like attendance records, immunization records, those kind of things, like they're responsible for giving you that if you ask for it, but also more of the like off paper stuff. So like how the parent interacts with the school when they come, or how the child looks when they show up to school, or how often they're in the office, right? They have such a wealth of knowledge. And so definitely always be super nice to them, be kind to them. They often don't get enough credit for what they do, but they are an amazing resource for you as a provider when you're hoping to partner with a school. The next level of a school system or something that's really important, no matter what your role is or no matter what your specifically with a child is, it's super important to find out if they're in special education in school. And because you might not always know. And so what special education is it could be an IEP or a 504 plan, but it's just essentially it's a document that's legally protected that says the school has identified that this youth has some kind of either disability or impediment to their learning. And we as a school legally have to provide accommodations to help them with their learning. And why it's so important for you as a provider to know that is because then that opens up a whole new set of providers that this child now is working with at the school. So they may now, because of this IEP, they may now have a speech therapist, an actual psychologist who gives them therapy once a week. They may now have OT, right? And so it's important for you to know what providers are working with the child in school so that you can either not have to worry about duplicating it outside of school or have people coordinate around their goals. So that's something that's really important to find out no matter who the youth client is. Also just wanted to make you aware, throw out the term non-public school placement. Sometimes you might have clients, especially, given the specialized programs that a lot of you are working in, you might have a client who is in special education, has an individualized education program, but the current public school that they're at is not meeting their needs. And so sometimes schools will then send the child to what's called a non-public school that has more specialized and integrated care. A lot of these definitely fall more on the integrated side of the spectrum to provide support for them. So that's also something really helpful for you to know if your client is attending a school like that. The next system is a medical system. And again, this won't always be necessary to collaborate with the medical system for every single client, especially if there's no pressing medical concerns. But you definitely always want to make sure that your client has a pediatrician, and is going for regular checkups. So that might be part of your work, especially if your role is more on the case management side to kind of help coordinate appointments or insurance or get them set up with a pediatrician. And then if your work is more on the clinical side and you're having to deal with diagnoses or things like that, you always, of course, want to rule out medical things first. So just making sure that your child client or youth client is in touch with a pediatrician. If your youth client is on any kind of medication, psychotropic medications, whether that's ADHD, depression, anxiety, and that means that there's likely a psychiatrist involved. So some of you might be lucky and work directly with them as part of your co-located or integrated team. So definitely it's important to coordinate with them. But if not, if you're more on that coordinated side, then you definitely want to reach out and touch base with the psychiatrist and just kind of get a feel for you as the care coordinator or as the clinician want to understand their medications, right? The purpose and their side effects, right? Just so you know, if you're hearing from the school that they're sleepy all the time and they're punishing the family for it, but you spoke to the psychiatrist and they said that's an impact of the medication. Now that's a way that you can advocate for the family so that they're not being punished for something that's, a side effect of the medication. So psychiatrist is an important person for you to touch base with. And then lastly, any specialists, again, this might be more rare, but if there are any medical circumstances that impact the mental health of a child. So for example, I've worked with students who maybe had like a heart condition or a seizure condition, and that really impacted their mental health or their anxiety. And so as a mental health professional, it's important for me to know how that medical condition shows up in their daily life so that I can give them tools for how to cope with it, so that I can be aware of how it shows up, so that I can then advocate for them, you know, in other spaces. So whether that looks like telling the school that they need more time for, you know, restroom breaks, or explaining their absences so that they're covered, you know, things like that. That's all really important when you're collaborating with the medical side for your youth clients. All right. So once you have identified who the key players are, who it would be most helpful to collaborate with, your next task in care coordination is how to go about doing that. And so again, as with a lot of things, it might be a little bit easier if you're in a co-located or integrated setting. You might already have, you know, a pre-existing team that you have norms around when to communicate, how to communicate, when meetings happen, when they don't. But if you have a really large caseload, or you're having to create your plan from scratch, the first important step is really triaging who to contact, because again, you can't contact every single person that exists in your youth client's life as much as you would love to. You know, you have to be more strategic. So really focusing on like the most pertinent domains of your child's, of your youth client's life that are impacting your mental health. So starting there as a first step. So, you know, if you're starting from scratch, you know, the old school ways of calling, or, you know, or you can email, you can go visit, all of these things are ways to put yourself on the radar of the provider that you're hoping to touch base with. And then you can move forward with more kind of formal ways. So that looks like meetings, right? Then it could look like, okay, well, now that I've emailed you, you know who I am, why don't we have a phone call once a month to, you know, to discuss updates on the client? Or why don't you join us, or I can join you for your bi-monthly case conference that you have for this child. You can kind of titrate it up to become more structured and more formal. That way you're really trying to implement systems for collaboration. That way it goes from not just being a one-off phone call, you want to eventually establish systems and procedures for how you're coordinating on behalf of your child. And again, if you are in a more integrated setting, or, you know, once you're able to do those kind of more informal ways of connecting, then you can have those more formal structures like the monthly case conferencing, depending on, you know, your agency policy, or child and family team meetings. I know that they're, you know, DCFS has their own, and Wraparound has their own methods for having the, you know, team meetings and things like that. But those are all really, really key in being able to have the space to coordinate and collaborate with other people. So you want to make sure that you get those as structured as possible. Warm handoffs are really, really an important engagement strategy. So especially during transition times. So say you're new to a case, you know, you're coming in as a new, either you're new to the organization or the client is new to your caseload. It is really helpful to have someone who the client maybe is already familiar with, or who's already been working with the providers, to introduce you. That way, you know, you're not starting from scratch or having to reinvent the wheel, or have time get lost where you're not touching base with other providers. So for example, if a therapist is leaving and you're coming in as the new therapist, maybe the outgoing therapist can send an email connecting you with their psychiatrist, or connecting you with the school counselor that they've been coordinating with. That way it can and continue, and vice versa, right? If you're leaving, or if you're know that a client is transitioning care, you want to connect them with the people that you've already been working with, and asking that of other people, right? If you hear that, you know, the parent partner that you've been talking to about this family for, you know, 3 years is leaving, then making sure you're asking, hey, can you put me in touch with your replacement? Or, you know, can you let me know when they find someone who's going to be taking over for you? That way you're not letting any transitions create a gap in service or communication. And that way you can also make sure that services are continuing to happen even in times of transition, because that's oftentimes when families experience service gaps the most, is during those times of transition. So that's really important. And then finally, it won't always be seamless, right? As we've discussed, and I'm sure you've already encountered, you don't always collaborate with partners who are interested in collaborating or have that same urgency. And so you might have to get creative doing things like maybe showing up in person to introduce yourself, or, you know, dropping by their office to drop off a business call or card or a file that you think would be really helpful or something like that. Sometimes you'll have to contact multiple people at an agency because maybe they'll get tired of you and then they'll nudge the other person. Hey, can you please call them back? Because I'm sick of them emailing me, right? So sometimes you have to be the squeaky wheel, right? To get in contact with people who it might be a little bit more difficult to reach. Using multiple methods. So, you know, if you've called and they're not returning your call, sending also an email saying, hey, sorry, I keep missing you. This is what I wanted to talk to you about. Because sometimes maybe they're not calling you back because they think it's going to be this hour-long conversation and you just don't have time for that. And, you know, just kind of stating, hey, I just wanted to ask you this one quick question, right? And so trying to make it as least daunting for the other person as possible. And then sometimes, unfortunately, maybe if it's something that's an urgent situation or a dire situation and you really need an answer or you really need to connect with someone else and they're not connecting back with you or collaborating with you, then, you know, using your supervisor, right? Maybe they know they're the other manager, they know the people at the other organization and can support you with that. Hopefully it doesn't come to that, but, you know, it's always something to have in your back pocket. All right. So as we continue to think about the communication and engagement methods to use to collaborate with key partners, one of the most important skills that you can have when you're collaborating with others is really the ability to function as a team, right? To be able to be a team player, to be able to know what you can commit to bringing to the table and what you can ask of others to bring to the table. So some really helpful kind of care coordination principles that can help to either be preventative or to ease some of those barriers that we talked about in the beginning, that these are ones that I found to be most helpful. So the first one is this idea of relational coordination. And so this refers to kind of the soft skills involved with care coordination that really can be just as important as the clinical and logistical pieces. So this is that mutual trust that you build with other providers where there's a common respect, understanding that you're all professionals, you know, just working as hard as you can for the sake of your client. And this is really important in these more complex settings and complex systems where there's a lot of moving parts for your youth client and you just can't do it all, right? No one wants to feel like they're solely responsible for the outcomes of all these domains for a youth client. But when you know that you have a team to rely on and to lean on, it can really help your feelings of competency towards meeting the goal and lower your burnout. Transparency, that just means, you know, being honest about the decisions that are being made, maybe mistakes or gaps that are coming up, and really being transparent about your capacity and your scope and skills as a professional. This really aids to build that relational trust too with other people. Discipline and commitment. And so this one, I don't want this to be confused with running yourself into the ground and having no regard for your mental health, right? I think a lot of times we hear, or I know I've heard before in the past, especially when you're working with kids, because we get into this work because we love children and we want to help them, we want to help families. And sometimes we run into agencies or cultures that may say, you know, if you care about the kids, you'll do whatever it takes. You won't stop until you get what you need without regard for, you know, with no caveat, no regard for mental health or burnout. And I definitely don't want to send that message to you. So when I say discipline and commitment, I mean working within your scope of practice, to the best of your ability with the tools and the capacity you have in that moment, right? And that could look different day to day. There are some days you have it in you and you have time to call the psychiatrist 6 times until they call you back. But there are other times where your mental health may not allow for that and you may only have one phone call in you. So, but just doing whatever you can with the skills and capacity you have in that moment and honoring that, because that'll lead to sustainability in the field so that you'll be around and you'll be with the family long enough to continue doing that. Humility, that just means, you know, having an open mind and recognizing that there's always something to learn, no matter how veteran you are, no matter you know, how long you've been with the agency or working with this family, that there's always something to learn from other people on the team, you know, no matter what your professional or personal background is, no matter what their background is, that there's no one viewpoint that's more superior than other, that all of you are looking at it from different viewpoints. So just being open to learning. Creativity, sometimes you're working within the constraints of, you know, county regulations or bureaucratic red tape, right, or HIPAA constraints. So sometimes you have to get a little creative in how you go about advocating or collaborating with your partners. But creativity can also mean just like changing up your practices, right? Being open to new and innovative ways of connecting with other people and conducting care coordination. Having clear roles is something that is super, super important, I think, because one big source of contention when you're doing collaborative work is having blurred lines or overlapping roles where multiple people feel like they're either doing the same thing or there's a lot of cooks in the kitchen. And this can lead to a lot of duplication of services. And so a lot of things being done not very well. So it's really important that everyone on the team understands, you know, what they're responsible for, what falls in their wheelhouse. And part of this also in creating that is making sure you have a clear facilitator and someone who's coordinating that. So maybe that's you, maybe that's someone else on the team. But research really shows that when there's a coordinator, when there's someone who's looking at it from kind of the bird's eye view and coordinating all these different roles and positions, outcomes are definitely better for clients. So that's a big part of the roles too. Curiosity just means, you know, always looking, kind of that what else piece that we saw in the wheelhouse. So always asking questions, thinking about what gaps exist and what else can be done. Shared goals is huge, because you might not all be coming from the same discipline, the same role, the same treatment goals, right? What you think your treatment goal would be as a therapist is going to be very different than the housing specialist goal, right? But if you all know that you're agreeing on one or two bigger overarching goals, it's going to be so much easier to feel connected to the team and connected to your piece within it and less overwhelming for you. So for example, if you know that you're working with a team and everyone is committed to the one overarching goal of lowering their depressive symptoms, right? And so then it's going to be easier for the psychiatrist to work on their goal of medication management because it fits that bigger overarching goal. And the parent partner can focus on getting the mom to teen mental health classes because it meets that overarching goal, right? And the school counselor can focus on mentoring because it meets that bigger overarching goal. So just making sure that everyone on the team is connected to this bigger picture can really help people function the best within their individual role. As with anything, effective and timely communication is pretty self-explanatory and key. And I think that especially helps our families to feel stable, right? To know that people are working with urgency and knowing and being transparent about that timeline can be really helpful. And then last but definitely not least is person-centeredness, right? So just remembering that even in the getting caught up in the minutiae of the day-to-day calls and tasks and follow-ups and care plans and all the different things, that at the center of that is a child and a family who is really trusting you just to make their life better, right? Oftentimes in the work that a lot of you are doing, you're seeing families at the lowest point, right? Or at the hardest, one of the hardest stages of their functioning. And so just always keeping that in mind that they're relying on you and trusting you to make things better. The next part of this kind of how this engagement piece is not only engaging with other systems, but engaging too with the family, right? How are you making sure that client and family voice is playing a big part in your collaboration? So again, as with the other providers, transparency, and this is really big and sometimes harder because a lot of these you're having to do, it's almost like you have two clients. Sometimes you're having to do these things with the family, with the caregivers, and with the child themselves, right? So trying as much as you can to be upfront about who you're reaching out to, why you're reaching out to that person, what meetings you'll be attending on their behalf. If you're scheduling a meeting on behalf of a client and you know that they're going to be there, telling them ahead of time who's going to be there, that can be really, really helpful. And I think being caught off guard or feeling like you're going behind their back can really dampen how much the caregiver then wants to collaborate with you. I remember I had an incident where I had a student that I was working with as a school counselor who was also involved in DCFS, and they were having a team decision meeting about them. And the social worker invited all the key players to come to this meeting, but she didn't tell the mom that she invited everyone. So when she saw me and one of the special education teachers show up to this meeting, she was super upset because she didn't want, you know, the intricate details of her DCFS case to all these details now get back to the school. And I definitely understood that. And I think that had the social worker maybe had a conversation with her ahead of time, she could have either eased some of her fears so that we were able to go, or if she still felt like we weren't necessary to go, then we could have just told the social worker our piece and been, you know, represented in that meeting. So that collaborative piece was missed out on because that transparency wasn't there in the beginning, maybe. And so, and of course, sometimes that transparency piece can't be there, right? Because of, you know, procedures, legal reasons, you know, confidentiality reasons. But as much as you can, trying to build that and just validating that families who are, especially if there's system involvement or DCFS involvement, there's already so much shame that can be put on them. And so making sure that you're doing whatever you can to make them feel like you're an ally and you have their best interests at heart. Shared goals, again, like before, it's really important for the family to feel like you're on the same page with them. And so that big overarching goal is going to be key. Meeting the family where they're at, and again, both caregiver and child is going to be really important. Just because you know that a certain care coordination task or you reaching out to another provider is going to really move this case forward and be super helpful, they may not be ready for that yet. And so, of course, there are some times where, you know, crises or court dates or, you know, deadlines come up where you don't always have the option of waiting for them to be ready. But if you can, if you have that flexibility, that's going to be really important, just to come from a place of, you know, exploring with them why they're not ready for that, why they don't want you to reach out to a specific provider. And when you ask questions, when you come from a curiosity place, you might find out that they don't want you to reach out to the child's pediatrician because the pediatrician just scolded them for giving the child chips, right? And they don't want to hear it from you too. Or the child might not want you to reach out to their teacher because they just failed a test and they're worried that you're going to scold them too, right? And so you might be able to provide, you know, demystify some of what goes on behind their back or some of that care coordination, or you might be able to hear really valid feelings, right? Or they might repeatedly be having these microaggressions with someone and you might want to know about it so that you can, as a provider, help to advocate, right? But meeting them where they're at is going to be really helpful. Of course, cultural factors is always important to keep in mind when you're working with a family, just being aware of some domains of a family's life may be more taboo to talk about in an open forum, like at a case conference or a TDM or something like that. So you want to be aware of that so that you're doing whatever you can to try and make accommodations to make them feel comfortable. Advocacy and building capacity, again, is super important for both parties, for the caregiver and for the child. Part of your role, whether you're on the case management side or the clinical side, is really to build the capacity and the skills of your family. And so modeling for the family how to navigate the healthcare system or the social service system and advocate for their needs. So this can look like, you know, going to appointments with them, showing them how you're accessing their medical records or their health records, or practicing with the parent how to ask for something from the school, helping them, you know, practice the language for it or giving them the language for how to advocate for what they need. And doing the same thing with kids, right? If the child is afraid to ask their teacher for something, then part of your counseling session can be helping them write a letter to their teacher, helping them, you know, ask their doctor for something, or helping them, giving them the language to describe something they're struggling with their doctor. So that part of your work, even if you're not directly speaking to a provider, you can give the family tools for how they speak to the provider. And that's still really, really helpful for the family. And then process checks. You know, so you might think that you walk away from a meeting or you walk away from a care coordination task and think, oh, wow, that went great. You know, we met our goal. We met our timeline of what we wanted to do. But it's also important to hear it from the family's perspective too, right? They might walk away thinking, oh, that meeting was terrible. Like nothing got done, right? So you want to know from both sides how you as a clinician or as a care coordinator see things and how the family feels like the plan is going. All right. And then this final piece is the what. So you've identified who to collaborate with, you figured out a couple tools for how to engage them and what to do. Now that you're face to face, or now that you're sitting in this meeting, what do you actually tell them? What do you exchange with them? And so let's first start off with what determines what you can share. So these are kind of the legal, ethical considerations to keep in mind when you're communicating with care partners. Every agency is different, right? So every agency or umbrella organization might have their own procedures and protocols. So that's definitely the first thing that you want to do when you're thinking about, okay, what can I share with this collaborator? In your agency protocols or handbook, it'll usually outline, you know, what client information is protected in your work, what's not, how do you keep client information confidential, what you don't need to keep confidential, and most importantly, who is considered part of your agency and who's not, because that will really determine who you need to take extra steps to collaborate with and who you don't. So for a lot of times, if you are working with a collaborator that is considered not part of your organization, you are going to need something called a release of information. It could also be called a disclosure or authorization for use or disclosure of protected health information. It varies based on agency, but the underlying idea is the same, that you need permission from your client or whoever is able to make their legal decisions when you want to exchange information with an outside provider. So most of the time, this doesn't mean that you, once you get the sign, now you can speak to everybody about whoever and tell every single thing that the child and family has ever said. It's always often very specific, right? So it'll identify a specific person or a specific agency or a specific role that you can talk to, what you can share with them, what you can't, the purpose of the communication, how long it's good for. You know, this form is only active for a year, and then after that, you have to reassess. And the family's right to revoke it at any time. So if you have a complex case and you're not in an integrated setting, you may need to get a lot of these forms signed for every single provider that you're working with. So it's really important to know your agency's regulations around that. Most agencies have their own specific form that they use. Sometimes you, in order to speak with a provider, you might need the family to sign your form and the other agency's form. And so definitely check in with your supervisors and your agencies to see what the regulations are around that. Because we're working with youth clients, I also want to bring up the idea of assent, because the minor clients that you're working with legally can't sign this consent form. They can't sign a form that says, yes, I give you permission to talk to my psychiatrist or talk to my school counselor. But that doesn't mean you don't have to consult with them at all, right? You still want to try and find some way to kind of, if you can, get informed consent from them. And that's called assent. That means just like talking to them about who you are trying to reach out to, who you want to reach out to, why you think it's important. And one of the biggest pieces is what you will share with them and what you won't. I've found that can be really scary to kids to hear. I'm going to talk to, you know, this person, because oftentimes, especially for younger kids, they think all the adults exist in a bubble, right? So like, how do you even know my doctor? How do you know my therapist? So sharing like, this is what I will tell them and this is what I won't. I won't talk to them about X, Y, and Z, you know, and that can really help them to feel more agency in a situation where legally they don't have as, you know, as many rights. And really, you know, just gauging their developmental level, right? What you share with a 5-year-old might be a little bit different than what you share with a 16-year-old about who you're partnering with on their behalf. Most of the rules that govern what you can share with other people legally are either determined by HIPAA or FERPA. This definitely is not a HIPAA training, so I won't go into too much detail. I'm sure all of you have had lots of onboarding about this when you started your organization. And I'm guessing most of you are probably bound by HIPAA, except for the few of you that might be school-based. But, you know, essentially, you know, HIPAA is just that there is protected health information for your clients that is kept confidential unless you have some kind of interest to share. And with that, you know, there are steps that you can take to get permission from the client to share that information. So definitely reviewing your agency policies on HIPAA, how that shows up, but most of your agency policies around confidentiality are probably shaped by HIPAA. And then same thing for FERPA, that just stands for Family Education Rights and Privacy Act. So, you know, the same way that HIPAA functions in healthcare settings, that's what FERPA is for schools. And so a lot of it overlaps. A lot of it is really similar, but there are some differences. So just being aware that if you are trying to coordinate with a school or you are contracting with a school, which we'll talk about in the next bullet point, that they're regulated by certain by a different act. And so if you are someone who maybe falls under both, you feel like you're a healthcare provider that works in a school, talking to your supervisor or your agency to find out where do you fall under? Which one do you honor? Especially in moments where they might conflict with one another. An MOU or a memorandum of understanding is a contract between two agencies that partner with each other to provide services to the same population. So I've seen this a lot in schools where a health clinic will partner with a school. So they'll send their staff on site to provide services to the children. And so when there's an MOU, a lot of times that will dictate what you're able to release to other people or not. So the MOU might say, you know, because we all work for part of this contract, I don't need a release of information to talk to you. Now I can share with you freely as if we worked for the same organization. So that's really helpful to know if that's something that's coming up for you and to read that language around that. The last part about the legal piece is that there are some instances where you won't need a legal release to speak with someone at first initially. And that's, you know, in situations, crisis situations where you're worried about the safety of a child. So if you're on this call, my guess is most of you, or if not all of you, are mandated reporters. So you know that if you are suspecting child abuse or neglect, then you have to make a, you know, suspected child abuse report to DCFS. And so in that, you are giving a lot of confidential information, right? You usually have to give the name, the demographic information of the family, your concerns about them. A lot of times you're having to release this confidential information. And so in order to make a report, you are legally allowed to reveal whatever you need to reveal to protect the child. Again, doesn't mean free rein to then like talk about every single thing that the family has ever said to you, right? But you are legally protected to share what you need to share, just enough of what you need to share to protect the child and to make the report. And then once, if a child abuse investigation is ongoing, whether you made the initial report or not, I know different agencies have different policies around what paperwork they need from DCFS moving forward to release information. So definitely make sure you're checking in with your organization around that. And then the same thing applies to harm to self or others, right? Say that you have a client that you're working with and you need to contact PMRT or hospitalization is necessary, then you don't need to then stop and get a release of information to call access, right? You, in that moment, you are allowed to release the whatever limited information you need to keep that child safe. And so that's just something to look at your agency policies around and be aware of. All right, the last part of the what is the should, right? So now that you know legally what the parameters around your communication is, here are just like a few guiding questions to help when you're actually in that space, when you're on that phone call, when you're in that email, when you're in that case conference meeting, what should I actually be talking about with other people? So the first one is just checking in around that authorization form. Sometimes that form might only say, you can only say if the child is attending your sessions or not. Then that's it, right? So that sometimes you're bound by what you can. But for the most part, you really want to decide what to exchange based on your role and your goals. So if you're asking for information from other people, you want information that helps explain the presenting problem for their point of view, right? How does the psychiatrist see it? How does the school counselor see it? How does the parent partner see it? You want to get important updates that you might need to be aware of from them. So sometimes like they might be aware of something that you weren't, like the family's moving or that their school is changing, you know, so updates like that. Any strategies or tips that have been helpful for them in their role that maybe you can use, you know, in your own setting. Anything that will be helpful for you to be able to do your job better in your scope. That's usually kind of the information that you want to elicit from other people. And then in that same vein, you know, using similar guidelines to decide what you share when you're speaking to someone else. So what is the presenting problem for your point, excuse me, from your point of view? What goals and strategies are you working on? Are there any important updates on the case? And if you're specifically serving as the facilitator or kind of a coordinator, you want to pick up on trends that are coming up. So is the client utilizing services across domains, right? Are any big red flags coming up in multiple settings? That way you can identify any gaps or anything. A next kind of guiding question to determine what to share is getting a feel for your culture of collaboration and the partnering agency's culture. So some agencies are super conservative, right? This is something that you're going to pick up through social cues. You might not know this, you know, when you first start or on paper. So some agencies are super conservative and tight-lipped and say, only share a little bit and what's necessary, and your supervisor needs to see it before it goes out. You know, some are more on the conservative side, whereas others may have more of kind of a gossipy feel. And there's, you know, a gamut in between the two. And so it's important just to be aware of how these cultures, you know, play out and how it might either pressure you to share more than you're comfortable with or than legally you're supposed to. So just keeping an eye on those factors that come up. The next one is just disclosures that may put your client at risk. Because again, you know, there's an added layer of vulnerability when we're working with kids, because we're not just telling their business, we're telling their family's business, right? And one thing that can come up when you're exchanging information with partners is that you say there's something that you don't think it's in the best interest of the child for the caregiver to know. And you tell a care partner, that partner may tell the family, right? And so as long as there's no, you know, mandated reporting issues or anything legally like that that you have to share, if there's something that you feel like will put the child's safety or, you know, your therapeutic relationship at risk by sharing with a partner because you don't want it to get back to the family or other partners, then, you know, maybe be more conservative and being careful of what you're sharing with other collaborators. And then finally, just managing their expectations of you, right? So at the start of your collaboration, when you sit down for that first meeting or when you first reach out through email, explaining your role, explaining what you will be sharing, explaining, you know, what you're bringing to the table, that way you're managing their expectations. So they're not expecting you to be sharing more than you feel comfortable with. All right. So I know that was a lot of information. So for the last kind of, we have 13 minutes left. I wanted to put some of these tips into practice and kind of see how we would go about navigating these collaborative situations in real time. So what we'll do, again, we're going to do this together. We're not going to do breakout rooms, but I'll read a scenario and then we'll just talk about a couple of discussion questions. And again, I want this to be as collaborative and participant focused as possible. So when we go over the questions, unmute yourself, you know, feel free to do whatever makes you comfortable. So the first one is, you are a therapist working with a child FSP program at a DMH contracted clinic. A 9-year-old client has been referred to you from his school counselor. The referral states that he has received school-based counseling through special education for the past 2 years. However, they're not seeing any improvement in his aggressive behaviors. He has frequent fights at school with both students and staff and has been suspended multiple times. He is especially irritable with others when he does not take his ADHD medication in the mornings. School administration states that if his behavior does not change, they will proceed with an expulsion hearing. He lives with his mother and 3 younger brothers. So let's start off with, who are the key care partners that you should collaborate with? So when you look at this case, who are some folks that you already know you want to talk to right away? The school counselor. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. The parent, school staff, family, psychiatrist who prescribed the medication. Yep. Absolutely. Good. I'm glad you picked up on, if there's medicine, that means there's a psychiatrist, right? Or it could be the pediatrician, but, you know, yeah, usually a psychiatrist. Okay, good. Let's see, mom, family, school. Yep, exactly. Good. Yes. These are all the partners that I would identify as well. How would you engage them? What are some strategies that you might do to reach out to some of these folks? And you can be creative. I didn't put in this in the vignette, you know, how long you've been working or, you know, if you know them already. So just off the top of your head, what would you use to engage them? Maybe some calls, right? We could call the psychiatrist, email. Yeah, it's always a great place to start, right? We can start from least invasive to most invasive, right? In person, yeah. Visiting, especially maybe visiting the school. And then what about what information would you want to exchange? Yeah, I like that. Create a group treatment plan. So what information would you want to know from these partners when you send that email, when you call, when you go in person? What do you want to know? Mm-hmm. What has worked in areas that need additional support? Yeah, that's a good one. How have they been tracking the progress of his behaviors? That data piece, right? That's super, super important. And then finally, how would you make sure that client and family voice is integrated in this collaboration? Family therapy. Family therapy is always, yeah, always a great strategy. And maybe talking to him too, right? Finding out from his point of view. We see it from the school's point of view. We see it from the referral, but what does he think? Yeah. Hearing from mom and how they feel like the behavior has changed. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely ensuring that caregiver and youth's input is considered and acknowledged. Yeah. This is a really great opportunity for you to find out a lot of information about how the key players see this situation. So from the psychiatrist's perspective, when you check in with him, you know, is there something that is making them not want to take the medicine? Is it supposed to be taken with food or, you know, at a certain time of day, you know, and what are some of the side effects that they don't like that maybe is making him not want to take the medication? Yeah, that's a really, really good point. How are they at home and how is that different from at school, right? Finding out how they are across settings can really give you great data because what's happening in one setting that you can try and implement in another. Good. Thank you all for that. I think we have time. Let's do one more. You are a child and family specialist working with a DMH wraparound program. Your client is a 15-year-old girl who was recently hospitalized after an attempted suicide. You have been working with this client for a year, and this is her second hospitalization. She currently lives with her grandmother temporarily after being removed from her mother's care for neglect concerns. Her wraparound therapist informs you at her that her discharge paperwork from the hospital is poorly filled out and does not give helpful next steps or a safety plan for her care team. You have been playing phone tag with her DCFS worker who informed you last week that grandma's concerned about mom's increasing attempts to regain custody despite not completing her parenting classes. So lots at play here. So who are some people that you would want to collaborate with? Grandma, DCFS worker, school counselor, yeah, to see if the behaviors are happening at school, therapist, teacher, yeah. The hospital too, right? You can, you know, get a release and seeing if you can get more info on her discharge papers, some safety plans. Yeah, supervisor at the hospital. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, definitely. So there's a lot of people that you can reach out to, her therapist, the hospital is going to be key to finding out, you know, what was going on with the discharge and what maybe they felt like next step should be. I know we're running out of time, so I'll combine, you know, some of the last couple of questions, but just how would you engage them? Like, what kind of information would you want to get? How would you engage the family? Just to kind of some other steps that you would do in this situation. But her response to treatment, if anything happened while she was in the hospital, that's definitely information you're going to want to know from the hospital, for sure. Information about that first hospitalization. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So kind of finding out the context, what's going on with grandma and mom, right? Because that's all going to impact the child too. Yeah, good. And finding out more from grandma is a way to integrate that family voice too, right? So using her as collateral. Yeah, so there, I mean, anytime that perhaps, yeah. So finding out, yeah, that what we talked about before, having that spirit of exploration, right, and curiosity, finding out why grandma's concerned. Is it because it's making the child upset, or is it because grandma doesn't trust mom, right? So in all of these situations, when you're working with a family, you know, it won't always come wrapped in a bow of here is the perfect plan, here's everyone who you need to identify, here's everyone who you need to contact, and here's the questions to ask them, right? You're going to have to kind of sift through and figure out who is at play and what you need to do to engage them. So hopefully some of these strategies have been helpful. But these are some helpful resources just that came up for me as I was, you know, preparing this and that I've used in the past, just on care coordination strategies and some best practices and laws and consent forms and things like that. So that's available for you. Should you want the more boring stuff, there's the references for you to look at. And that's it. If there are no questions, then I really, really appreciate your time. Thank you all so much for coming and signing in and being so engaged. And I look forward to hopefully seeing you at future trainings.